Okay, so I've been working on these meetings, putting these things on for 7 or 8 years now. We used to do it in my living room. We've been doing it here in this building for about 4 years, I think. Time flies, and I kind of lose track of time. I have never, ever promoted anything commercially before that I was involved with at all, or even things that I wasn't involved with, except Kurt's used book, you know, sale there in the back. And it's kind of more of a service than anything else, as far as I'm concerned. You remember, for those of you, who was here in June, the June meeting? Three or four of you? I don't remember what it was about. Anyway, you might remember me saying this, though. I said that I was working on something that would be an alternative to Obamacare, that would be an alternative for people to have health coverage without having to be in the system. Does anybody remember me alluding to that? And people said, what was it about? What is it? And I said, no, you can't. I can't tell you yet because we're not ready. We have some flyers that are in the back, and I would encourage you, and you don't owe this to me. This is some, you know, this may not be for you. I totally get it. But I would encourage you to take a flyer, look at the website. It doesn't cost you anything. And the website's called, for those of you who don't get a flyer, healthsharepro.com. It's an alternative to Obamacare. It is ACA exempt. It is exempt from Obamacare. For those of you who were like me who said, I'm not getting involved with that system. I'll pay the hundreds now and the soon-to-be $1,000 fines, penalties, because I'm not going in there come hell or high water. If you were like me and said that, now you have an option, an alternative, where you don't have to pay the fine. You are exempt. The documentation from the House bill is in there. You don't have to believe me. It's all there documented. And you can read it online on the House bill for the whole 1,000-page ACA, and it's footnoted and highlighted and referenced. So I would encourage you to look at it. For those of you who aren't on Medicare, for those of you who don't have a great employer-paid health care package, this is something you need to look at, and it's very cheap. You'll save over 50% or more over what you'd pay on insurance. That's my plug from me. I'm involved with this business. Take it for what it's worth, and if you don't look at it, it's fine. It's your loss. Okay. To introduce the speaker now, I would like to read a quick quote from Cicero, and then I'll introduce Mr. Michael Gaddy. Quote, okay, this is Marcus Tullius Cicero from about, I think, 90 B.C. or 90 A.D., one of the two. He said, quote, and you've heard this before. I think this would be a good lead-in for Mr. Gaddy. A nation can survive its fools, even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within. An enemy at the gates is formidable, for he is known and carries his banner openly. But the traitor moves amongst those within the gate freely, his sly whispers rustling through all the alleys, heard in the very halls of government itself. For the traitor appears not as a traitor. He speaks in accents familiar to his victims. He wears their face and their arguments. He appeals to the baseness that lies deep in the hearts of all men. He rots the soul of a nation. He works secretly and unknown in the night to undermine the pillars of the city. He infects the body politic so that it can no longer resist. A murderer is less to fear. So, Michael Gaddy comes to us tonight. I actually heard him on K-Talk Radio, on a radio program with talk show host Dale Williams, who's also here tonight, a few months back. I think it was May, perhaps. And I caught the tail end of the show, and I was very impressed. So I called Dale. I said, Dale, please tell me that guy lives somewhat sort of locally so we could have him come speak. Because, you know, I mean, here we are begging for $3 for you to help us pay for his hotel. You know, we can't fly in guys from New York or Virginia or different things like that, not with this kind of a venue. Anyway, Mr. Gaddy is a retired military 30-year veteran, and he's probably going to correct some of my on this intro here. And I'll let him just do most of it. He did a stint with the Pentagon and with the NSA. And he's going to share some exciting, interesting experiences with us tonight. I won't go over his whole biography, but you got the email on it. Without any further ado, let him speak. Let him do his presentation. We'll have questions and answers if he's open to it at the end after he's done. And that way we can stay on track and topic. And without any further ado, please welcome Michael Gaddy.
Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, folks. I appreciate the offer to be here. I am going to stand for as long as I can, but at some point in time, I'm going to have to sit down. Last Friday, I was riding my Harley down the road, and a truck decided to turn in front of me. He decided he would make a turn in front of me, and I dropped the bike and slid across the pavement for a while. The worst part of me you can't see. You're a lot better off. But I'm still a little stiff from that, but we'll make sure it works. One of the things I think I was just telling Thomas as we were enjoying our picnic, and I made a statement, and I honestly believe that's true in our country today. The hardest thing to sell in this country is the truth. The truth is really hard to sell, and I have found in teaching the Constitution and teaching the truth of our founders, when you go about doing it, usually you have to give real small doses. Because if you give people too much of the truth, they run away like their hair is on fire. They don't want to hear anymore because they would much rather have the comfortable lie. How many of you people like to be comfortable? How many of you like to be free? We have reached a point in America where you cannot be both. As tragic as it is, you cannot be both. Hold on a second. Let me get my outline here up on this so I can get back to the story here. How many of you think that you're conversant in the U.S. Constitution? How many of you think you know what the founders intended for our government to be like? How many of you think our founders intended for us to have a democracy? John Adams says a democracy, there has never been a democracy that didn't commit suicide. James Madison didn't want a democracy. None of the founders wanted a democracy. They knew the perils of a democracy. But if you turn on the news today, every plastic talking head on television will tell you we are a democracy. And we're making countries safe for democracy. I guarantee you, if you go to a foreign country, and I've been to quite a few, and tell them how wonderful our democracy is, they'll tell you they don't want any of it. And the wonderful thing about our democracy is we take it to foreign countries and we say, here, take this. If you don't like it, I'll kill you. You didn't expect that from a veteran, huh? Pardon me while I get this going here. I should have done this earlier. Now that should bring it up. And we'll get into the program here. I got a quote for you I'd like to start with, and it is this: most human beings only think they want freedom. In truth, they yearn for the bondage of social order, rigid laws, and materialism. The only freedom man really wants is the freedom to become comfortable. That is anonymous. I'm not exactly sure where it came from. I found it years ago, and I love it. Now, this one I will give you from Thomas Jefferson. Anybody heard of him? When is the last time a U.S. president quoted Thomas Jefferson? Reagan quoted Thomas Jefferson, but it wasn't a Thomas Jefferson quote, even though he said it was. If you want to see authentic and you want to authenticate any Thomas Jefferson quote, go to www.monticello.org. The Monticello Foundation has a very good section on the, they will not only tell you whether it's authentic or not, they will tell you where it originated. The last president to actually mention Thomas Jefferson was John Kennedy. Does that tell you? Because Thomas Jefferson's belief in government and what our government has become over the last 50 years are diametrically opposed to each other. Here's a quote from Jefferson. "Experience hath shown that even under the best forms, those entrusted with power have, in time and by slow operations, perverted that power into tyranny. And it is believed that the most effectual means of preventing this would be to illuminate, as far as practicable, the minds of the people at large, and more especially to give them knowledge of those facts which history exhibiteth. That, possessed thereby of the experience of other ages and countries, they may be enabled to know ambition under all its shapes, and prompt to exert their natural powers to defeat its purposes." What he's telling us is that we must be knowledgeable of history to understand ambitions of men and women who would take us to places where our country never intended to be. So you have to be knowledgeable of history in some respects to be able to see these things, which our founders were very good at. There's a few more, and you will think in a very short time that my favorite founder was Thomas Jefferson, and that is incorrect. He's one of my favorites, but my absolute favorite was Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was acknowledged by Washington as the most devout Christian among the founders. Washington, Madison, and all the others talked about Henry and his devout Christianity. In the first item in Patrick Henry's will that he left to all of his children and grandchildren was the gift of Christianity. But I'll go back to Jefferson here for a minute. We'll get to some of the Patrick Henry quotes and how many people knew that he never attended the Constitutional Convention of 1787? Do you know why, sir? No, that was Jefferson. I'm sorry, sir. Patrick Henry. Yes, sir. No. Washington was very upset because he wouldn't come. But when Patrick Henry was invited, and he was actually elected by the state of Virginia to attend, he had four words: "I smell a rat." And he would not attend. Here's some quotes that I think I would like for all of you to keep. And let me say this. If you would like this total outline and my total presentation, if you'll pass around a sheet of paper and put your email address, I'll make sure you get the whole thing. Here's an extract from Thomas Jefferson's summary view of the rights of British America in July of 1774. "The God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time." An extract from Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, 20 December 1787. "The people are the only sure reliance for the preservation of liberty." Extract from Thomas Jefferson to Charles Clay, 27 January 1790. "The ground of liberty is to be gained by inches, that we must be contented to secure what we can get from time to time and eternally press forward for what is yet to get. It takes time to persuade men to do even what is for their own good." Now, here is a quote that has been credited to George Washington. I don't like to give quotes randomly without checking for their authenticity. I have tried to confirm this quote because I love it, but the earliest existence of this quote I can find is in 1902. But you will find it. You will find, if you look it up, it's attributed to Washington in many places, and that quote is, "Government is not reason. It is not eloquence. It is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. Never for a moment should it be left to irresponsible action." You can see why I like the quote, whether Washington said it or not. Did our founders intend for us to have a national government or a federal government? What's the difference? Say again, sir.
Centralization.
Centralization of government is very good. That is exactly it. James Madison already had a plan for our government before he ever got to the Constitutional Convention in 1787. He called it the Virginia Plan. Madison was about 5'4". He had a real squeaky voice. No, I'm not old enough to have heard him. But he had a real squeaky voice, and he was very much concerned that if he presented the Virginia Plan, that it wouldn't be accepted because of his stature and because of his voice. So he turned to the governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, and he said, "I want you to present this for me." He actually sent him a copy of the Virginia Plan before the convention actually began. The Virginia Plan was a nationalist form of government which would have done away with all the states. Madison wanted the states to be no more than simple corporations. I'm going to blame Thomas for this, but how many constitutional public servants do you think we have in our country today?
Zero.
No, no, no. Who said zero? I'm going to prove you wrong.
We'll see about that.
Okay. Good. I'm up for the challenge because Thomas didn't really tell me this, but I'm going to lie and say he did. He told me that this is kind of like school. You had to bring show and tell. So I brought our constitutional county commissioner just to prove you wrong back there, sir. Stand up, Keenan, please. We do not have a federal government. We have a national government. We also in this country have 535 highly overpaid people who have little to no clue what their job is. I would suggest if you really want to see how constitutional he is, come to our county commissioner meeting and watch him take the BLM and the Forest Service apart. I don't go anywhere without a gun. And I warned him when he first became a commissioner, make sure you have one too, buddy. Keenan was telling us last night at dinner that he interviewed a young lady for a job with our county government, and on her resume, she was a U.S. government teacher. She had taught U.S. government. Keenan asked her, said, "Well, how much time do you spend on the Constitution in your class?" And she said, "One day." You mentioned Obamacare earlier. Just as an example, 2012, The state of North Carolina voted in their legislature almost overwhelmingly to outlaw the Affordable Care Act in the state of North Carolina. But their attorney general, a gentleman by the name, a man by the name of Roy Cooper, told them after they passed the legislation, before the governor signed it, he said, it's totally unconstitutional. You cannot do that. And he quoted Article 6, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution. But he left out five words. He didn't even put the ellipsis indicating he had left, which is fraud. If you don't put an ellipsis in there to tell people you left words out, you're trying to defraud somebody. So he put in Article 6, Section 2 in its entirety with the exception of five words, in pursuit of the Constitution. Now, we can all say shame on Mr. Cooper, but I would rather say shame on the 170 members of the North Carolina legislature that didn't know they'd been had. So where out of 170 people in that General Assembly, they needed one person to stand up and say, I'm sorry, Mr. Attorney General, you are trying to deceive us. And therefore, I will begin impeachment proceedings tomorrow. But they didn't have it. And I'll get to those quotes. Thank you very much, ma'am. I'll get you to those quotes about Madison about the in Federalist Paper number 10. Madison said, measures are often, too often decided not according to the rules of justice and the right of the minority party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. How many of you are familiar with the Articles of Confederation? If we had gone by the Articles of Confederation, could we have had the Constitutional Convention of 1787? Nope. The founders of this country seceded. That's a bad word in government today. The founders of this country seceded. They had to secede from the Articles of Confederation to even have the convention. Why so? Because the Articles of Confederation, I think it's Article 13, states that any action by anyone had to be unanimous. Every state had to agree to it. Didn't happen. Rhode Island refused to attend the 1787 convention. That's why I like to call them Rogue Island. And when Rhode Island voted on ratifying the U.S. Constitution in 1788, they voted 26-0 to reject it. How many of you learned that in school? And I do have it here. Article 13. Every state shall abide by the determination of the United States and Congress assembled on all questions which by this confederation are submitted to them. And the articles of this confederation shall be inviolably observed by every state, and the union shall be perpetual. So the founders who attended 1787 were violating their own Articles of Confederation. Nor shall any alteration at any time hereafter be made in any of them unless such alteration be agreed to in a Congress of the United States and be afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state. We had some people who are founders, and I'm going to mention their names, and you probably were told in school they were really great people, and I'm going to tell you tonight that they weren't so great. because we had two people especially who wanted to hijack this government and use it for their own purposes. One of them was James Madison, the other was Alexander Hamilton. And they started in 1786. How many of you are familiar with the, the Annapolis Convention? They tried to hijack the government in 1786 with a convention in Annapolis, Maryland, where they had asked all the states to show up. John Jay, anyone ever heard of him? First Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. John Jay sent a letter to George Washington, and he said, "These Articles of Confederation aren't working because we do not have the ability to coerce." So, kind of gives you a different perspective on the Constitution you learned about, right? I'm not going to tell you it's bad. But I'm going to tell you about some good people who were founders you've probably never heard of, who made these people declare what this Constitution was about against what they actually wanted to do. And they did it in the ratification conventions. All of the states in 1786 and 1787, early on, were invited to send delegates to Philadelphia in May, the third Monday of May of 1787, to amend the Articles of Confederation. The exact wording, to amend the Articles of Confederation. When the Constitutional Convention opened on May 14, 1787, which was the second Monday, only delegates from Pennsylvania and Virginia were present. It wasn't until May 25th that a quorum of seven states was achieved. Whether the ever-convenient excuse was blamed for the tardiness, but the convention was plagued throughout with attendance issues. How many people were invited to attend the Constitutional Convention of 1787? 77 people. Did you know that they met in a building on the second floor with all of the shades drawn with an armed guard outside? No one was to know what happened in that convention, and they made a solemn oath to each other it would not be revealed for 50 years. If we got a group of politicians today that decided to have that meeting, how many of you would be good with that? While James Madison boasted that he never left the proceedings for more than a casual fraction of an hour, his fellow delegates were not as fastidious. 19 of the 74 that the Rhode Island didn't show up. So 19 of the 74 delegates to the convention never attended a single session. And the 55 delegates who did show up in Philadelphia, no more than 30 stayed for the full 4 months. New Hampshire's delegation arrived 2 months late, by which time two of New York's three delegates had left in protest. And I will read you their letter to Governor George Clinton, no relation to our present tyrannical duo. Alexander Hamilton was the only representative from New York left behind. If you go to the official proceedings of the Constitution, you will see on votes after Lansing and Yates left to go back to New York because they felt the convention had been hijacked. By the time all votes after that show the states voting, and you will see Alexander Hamilton listed afterwards. New York did not have a quorum. Alexander Hamilton voted, it never counted. Now, as I told you, Robert Yates, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the state of New York, and John Lansing, an attorney, they left. I would like to read you their letter so that you can understand. Their letter to Governor Clinton goes as follows. Sir, we do ourselves the honor to advise Your Excellency that, in pursuance to concurrent resolutions of the Honorable Senate and Assembly, we have, together with Mr. Hamilton, attended the convention appointed for revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting amendments to the same. This is what they were, the powers they were given by the people in New York. It is with the sincerest concern we observe that, in the prosecution of the important objects of our mission, we have been reduced to the disagreeable alternative of either exceeding the powers delegated to us and giving assent to measures which we conceive destructive to the political happiness of the citizens of the United States, or opposing our opinions to that of a body of respectable men to whom those citizens had given the most unequivocal proofs of confidence. You could put all of the congressmen in Washington, D.C. together, and they couldn't write a paragraph that eloquent. Thus circumstanced, under these impressions, to have hesitated would have been to be culpable. We therefore gave the principles of the Constitution, which has received the sanction of a majority of the convention, our decided and unreserved dissent. But we must candidly confess that we should have been equally opposed to any system, however modified, which had in object the consolidation of the United States into one government. Two men of honor. How many of you have ever heard of them? If you were a snake in the grass, you wouldn't want to tell people how honest these two guys were. That's why our educational system is like it is. You don't hear about these people that we have who were honorable people who stood up. He says, we beg leave briefly to state some cogent reasons which, among others, influenced us to decide against a consolidation of the states. These are reducible into two heads. First, the limited and well-defined powers under which we acted and which could not, on any possible construction, embrace an idea of such magnitude as to assent to a general constitution in subversion of that of our state. A conviction of the impracticability of establishing a general government pervading every part of the United States and extending essential benefits to all. Our powers were explicit and confined to the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation, and reporting such alterations and provisions therein as should render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. Now, Madison introduced his Virginia plan. Edmund Randolph did, but it was Madison's plan, written far in advance. I say far, I mean 2 months at least, by record. The delegates voted it down 7-2. Said, we didn't come here to establish a central government that would control the acts of everything and override our states. So then the great argument began. And the great argument that proceeded for over a month was the big states against the small states. The small states were worried that if we had representation by numbers, the large states, the large populous states, would rule the nation. And the comment was made by David Ramsey from South Carolina. How many of you ever heard of that founder? He said that we cannot allow this to happen because at the time that our founding fathers were together in 1787, South Carolina had more slaves in it than they had free people. As we discussed at dinner last night, how many of you have heard the hue and cry from people that blacks were only 3/5 of a person in the Constitution? I agree, that's deplorable. The northern states wanted them to have no. They didn't want them to be represented at all. The South insisted that they be at least 3/5 of a person, if not a whole person, because without that they would have had no representation in the government. Kind of an interesting fact. They didn't tell you that in high school either, did they? That letter is much longer, and if you want to get my notes, if you put your email address down, I have the entire letter from Yates. How many of you had ever heard about that letter? How many of you had ever heard that there was dissension in the ranks? I did in college. I sure didn't hear about it in high school. The story I was told in high school is these great bunch of friends got together in 1787, had a party, we had a constitution. And everybody loved everybody. Well, shortly after this argument had been going on for quite some time, of all people, Benjamin Franklin said, "We are getting absolutely nowhere. We've spent a month arguing amongst ourselves, and we have achieved absolutely nothing. So I believe we should revert to our first constitutional convention and that we should begin each and every day with prayer." Now stop and think about something. This was coming from Benjamin Franklin. And Franklin made that suggestion, to which Alexander Hamilton stood up in protest and said, "We should not submit these proceedings to a foreign power." That Constitutional Convention from May until September never had a word of prayer in it. Not one. When the Articles of Confederation were led every day in prayer. Hamilton got mad. He left. The first time. Hamilton left the Constitutional Convention 5 times during a 4-month period of time. I have tried to establish this link, which I'm not able to do except by conjecture, and I admit that. But I believe his later actions once he was Secretary of Treasury, I believe that Hamilton's visits were made back to New York to visit with his father-in-law, Philip Schuyler, who owned 40% of what is now the state of New York, and Schuyler's connections with the Bank of England. I wish I could prove that. Please understand, I'm not stating that as fact. That's conjecture. But I think there's a lot of evidence there, especially since Hamilton immediately wanted a national bank. So, again, and this is one thing I ask all. I teach Constitution in 3 different counties down where we live, and I ask everybody. You will never offend me. If you find anything that disproves something that I've told you, please contact me. Because I don't want anything to be tainted. And I research. My wife can probably tell you, she's sitting in the back. She's seen me up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when I can't sleep, trying to chase down a quote or a fact or something to that nature. I want to be as accurate as I possibly can in this presentation. So after we have this Constitutional Convention, which I'll go into detail in just a minute, we ended up with 2 groups of people called the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist. The Federalists were not Federalists. The Federalists were Nationalists. The Anti-Federalists were the Federalists. Exactly. Things haven't changed much, have they? So today in our country, we have a huge problem of which we're all aware. And Thomas, I like your admonition to the people here to talk to people, to try to get people to understand, to get more people interested. But you and I are not going to do that. And as hard as we try, we don't reach a lot of people. Has anybody out there had just absolute success? Everybody you talk to comes running down to your meetings? But what is happening is this. We have a great ally in our effort, and it's called the U.S. government. And the more people they push in the ditch, the more people who will see what is happening in our country, and then your words will fall on prepared ground. And we have to depend on our enemy, and I consider the U.S. government my enemy, and that's hard for me. You don't wear that uniform for 30 years and then discover what your country is, and it really bothers you. So our problem with the Constitution is this. We have a Constitution, but the government interprets it for us. And our country is too ignorant to know when they're being had. I thought I was going to fall over this afternoon sitting in the motel room when a Democratic congressman from California was on C-SPAN or something saying about this war with ISIS. He said, we have to go back to our Constitution. Congress has to declare war. This was a Democrat saying that. These things are illegal. They're going wrong. He was a young man. I don't know how he got to be a Democrat. Fell on his way to work, I guess. No, ma'am, I'm not indicating that Republicans are better. I promise you. Let's not forget for a minute that 128 Republicans voted to fund Obamacare and then came home to campaign against it. We have one in our area who will not shake hands with me, as a matter of fact. And he does not attend meetings where I might be. But the Constitution that is interpreted by our government is 180 degrees out of phase as our Constitution as was ratified. Does anyone know the difference? These anti-federalists were tough. Now, Delaware, anybody that would name their football team the Blue Hens, but Delaware wanted to be the first state to ratify the Constitution. If you look at their license tag, it says the first state. Should be the first state of idiots because they voted without reading it. They wanted to be first. No one read the Constitution in Delaware. They went, oh, let's vote for it. Oh, yes, I'm good. Nancy Pelosi, we'll find out what's in it after we pass it. Yes. Good example. I didn't know she was from Delaware. Joe Biden is, yes. Mm-hmm. I wish you hadn't said that word. I was feeling good till now. So then you had Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was trying to beat Delaware to be the first state. And this is just a few weeks after the Constitution was sent to Congress, and Congress forwarded it to the states with no comment. They didn't recommend it. They didn't say don't vote for it, but Congress sent it to the states without any other word. So we had three guys rush to New York. Two of them were New Yorkers anyway. We had John Jay and Alexander Hamilton. James Madison, who Congress was in New York at the time. So James Madison joins them, and they start writing the Federalist Papers. Now, I'm imagining this part, but the three of them get together, and they get there, and they say, well, you know, we left enough loopholes in this thing to where we can make it work if we interpret it, but we've got a real job now because we've got to sell this to a lot of people who don't like it. So let's become real good salesmen and tell everybody what they want to hear what this Constitution's about. Now, if you read number 9 of the Federalist Papers that was written by Hamilton and then read number 10 by Madison, which is probably the most quoted, if you believe those two came from different people, I got some oceanfront property down in between Utah and Colorado for sale. Read 9, read 10. It's like one letter. Now, if Madison wrote 10 and Hamilton wrote 9, they got together on it because it's just too much, too good. So the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, they wanted to vote it in because they were trying to beat Delaware. So they had all of their delegates there that had been elected to vote on ratification. And a couple of them, let's see, John Whiteside, John Finley, trying to think of the other one. They had 3. And we had a unusual, pardon me for bouncing around here a little bit, but we had an unusual occurrence in the fact that the people who lived in rural America in 1787 didn't want this Constitution. The people who lived in the big towns did. Does that sound familiar? We back to where we are today? But these 3 men decided, they looked around and said, along with a couple of other their compatriots, and said, if we go to this convention, we're going to be outvoted, because they had called it for that evening. If we go, we're going to be outvoted, and we're going to go ahead and ratify this thing, and we won't have time for any arguments. We won't have time to present anything. So they hid, because that, they took away the quorum. So what did the other guys do? Hunted them down, beat them up, and dragged them to the convention center. Sound like Chicago politics? But enough people saw what they had done to beat these guys up and drag them in to where they said, no, we're not going for this. If we have to do it this way, no. So they put off the ratification convention. We had several people at the Philadelphia convention. And if I could make a recommendation, I also send to all the people who take my classes, I send out a reading list. If you would like to have that reading list, let me know. I'll be happy to send you that as well. There was a lady who was a professor. Her name was Pauline Meyer. She is now deceased. She wrote a fantastic book called Ratification of the Constitution. And she goes through each state's individual process for ratification, including all of the complete arguments on each point. The state of Virginia took the Constitution and started at Article 1, Section 1, and went all the way through it. Discussed each and every point. They said they were going to do it in order, but that didn't happen. But they did discuss the entire Constitution. Patrick Henry almost convinced enough people to vote against it to keep it from being ratified in Virginia, but it would not have made any difference because New Hampshire had ratified and they had the 9. But if you want to read some eloquent speeches, I'm trying to think what day in June it was, second day I believe it was, Patrick Henry spoke for 7 hours without a teleprompter. That, my friends, is passion. When you feel about something that strongly that, and he, you know, it wasn't one of those things where he repeated himself. And I love going back and reading that presentation on that day. I think it was June the 17th. I may be wrong. But he just so eloquent in his presentation. But Patrick Henry was a wordsmith, if you know your history. That great presentation at St. John's Church, which ended with "Give me liberty or give me death." Read the rest of it. It's better than "give me liberty and give me death or give me death." He was also the youngest member of the House of Burgesses when the Stamp Act came along. And all of these people in there in their nice powdered wigs, the older people, and they had told Patrick Henry, he was 38, and he was in there with a lot of people around 50. And Patrick Henry was told, as a new member, you're to be seen and not heard. Yeah, that didn't work. He listened to the people make their presentations. And if you read the "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death" speech, the people had already said, well, you know, what can we do? We're looking at the biggest military on our planet. We're looking, what chance do we have? What chance do we have? We have no chance. We can't do this. Patrick Henry's speech is just absolutely beautiful. He addressed that. I especially like the part, and I'm paraphrasing, if we are a righteous people, the majesty of this world will bring up allies in our favor. And that happened in the Revolutionary War. People might have got mad and not liked the French when they refused to help us invade Iraq, and we had resolutions in Congress to not call them French fries anymore. Well, I tell you what, if that doesn't speak to their level of intelligence, that they talk about food instead of about Congress should have declared that war. Of course, if Congress would have declared that war, we would have found out all the lies that had been told, right? At least they would have debated it. So Patrick Henry made in the Stamp Act. And if you read the Stamp Act, when Patrick Henry got up to speak, and he was pretty eloquent, but about halfway through, the rest of the Virginia House of Burgesses were chanting treason. Because he was opposing King George III. And several of the people were saying, treason, treason. But he was so eloquent that he got those five, of course, they adopted five different articles while he was there, and once he left, they got scared and dissolved two of them. But the other states, the other colonies found out about it. Now let's look at some ratification agreements. How many people know that their ratification agreements were written? I would like to read you the ratification agreement from the state of Virginia. Pay close attention, please. We, the delegates of the people of Virginia, duly elected in pursuance of a recommendation from the General Assembly and now met in convention, having fully and freely investigated and discussed the proceedings of the Federal Convention, and being prepared as well as the most mature deliberation hath enabled us to decide thereon. That's the preamble. Here's the meat. Do in the name and in behalf of the people of Virginia declare and make known that the powers granted under the Constitution being derived from the people of the United States may be resumed by them whensoever the same shall be perverted to their injury or oppression. How many of you knew that? That's a ratification agreement. Two states joined them with almost identical language. Believe it or not, New York and Rhode Island. So we have a conundrum here. Either these three states were allowed into the Union with that provision, or they were never states. And if you go to Article 4, Section 2 of our Constitution and read Article 4, Section 2, it will tell you that all states have the same privileges. So if Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York have these privileges of leaving any time they start being mistreated by their government, we all do. And everyone, I'm sure, is familiar with the Equal Footing Clause. And you have some very brave county commissioners in the southern part of this state that are poking it to them, too. Equal footing, the U.S. government said when you come in as a state, that you come in on equal footing with all of the previous states. The largest percentage of land owned by the federal government in a state east of the Mississippi is 4%. Out here in the West, the majority of our states are owned by the federal government. It's unconstitutional. And they're trying to drive us out. They want to go to, the lady passed it around, you'll learn about this, they want to go to Agenda 21. Have any of you read Agenda 21? What's their goal? 200 people per acre. How do you get 200 people per acre? It has to be this way because you can't do it that way. They're going after water, the lifeblood of the West. How long ago was that we started that little action down in our county? I formed my own corporation, people call Water Rights Montezuma. You know how many people's in my group? Me. And I opposed their request from the Bureau of Land Management to take 6.2 gallons per second? 6.2 CFS. Thank you, sir. That's why we elected him. He's smarter than us. They want to take that out of an agricultural canyon. We've got farms and ranches that have been there for 100 years. You take that much water out of that canyon, those people will be forced to go someplace else. And I have had fun fighting this. And it has been a lot of fun to go in and throw the Constitution at judges and at lawyers for the Bureau of Land Management. I really had a good time with Mr. Smith, the head of the BLM for the state of Colorado. He came down to meet with those of us who were protesting. And he said, "What is your complaint, sir?" And I said, "Failure to adhere to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. And he said, "What?" And I said, "Did you take an oath to the Constitution, sir, when you took your office? How long have you been with BLM? 25 years. Did you take an oath of office? Did you swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States?" "Nope." The lady sitting next to him said, "Yeah, you did." He didn't know it. And he said, Article what? And somebody with the government had a pocket constitution. Now, that should be a national holiday. One of them had a pocket constitution and came out with it, and he's going through it, and he's going, what was that again? I said, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. I'll quote it for you if you'd like. He said, no, not. He's looking for it, and he said, what? I said, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. I said, sir, if that's the Communist Manifesto you have in your hand, it's not going to be in there. Do you see why our congressman won't shake hands with me? That is their intentions. And again, we go back to our founding. Our people from rural America have a different mindset. Patrick Henry said that at 13 colonies, it was too large for one government because you'd had too many varied interests to treat them all fairly. And that was when we had 13 colonies, people. About 50 states now, unless, what, Obama said, 52? 57. I'm sorry, I forgot. That's obviously one of those would be the state of insanity. This Constitution that we have as ratified, people will bring liberty back to this country. Because our founders, and not the ones you normally hear about, they argued. How many ratification conventions did North Carolina have before they finally passed and agreed to the Constitution? Three. Took them a while. Rhode Island and North Carolina came in after the other 11. Almost a year later. And they were almost forced in because they were told they would be treated as enemy countries. Now let's talk about the only thing we have in which these ratifying conventions forced upon the people who wanted the Constitution. It's called the Bill of Rights. You folks read the Bill of Rights for the state of Utah? What's listed first? Every state in this union lists a Bill of Rights before it lists any powers for the government, because the people are first. But we would not have had what we have if it hadn't been for the Bill of Rights. James Madison, and I refer to James Madison as the Bill Clinton of the founding era, because James Madison could come down on both sides of an issue in the same sentence. But James Madison in Congress, the states submitted 212 proposed articles for a Bill of Rights. Can anyone tell me what was number one? The most submitted amendment to the Constitution is what now sits as the 10th Amendment. There was more of those submitted than anything else. Patrick Henry fought like the devil to get the Bill of Rights into existence. Read the Virginia Ratification Conventions and you'll see it. Over and over and over again, he fought for a Bill of Rights. New York said, if we don't get a Bill of Rights, we won't sign. We won't ratify. So he got 212, and he reduced those 212 down to 12. And in so doing, he consolidated quite a bit, but he took out what Patrick Henry wanted as an amendment to our Constitution. Took it out completely and totally. Patrick Henry didn't support the Bill of Rights. And if you read a lot of the people who wrote about Patrick Henry, they said in his old age he became a crotchety old man and couldn't get along with anybody. That may be true. But I want you to stop and think for a moment, had his amendment been one of the 10 or one of the 12, how much better off we would have been in this country today. His amendment was very simply stated that no direct tax shall ever be placed on the people of this country. And I mentioned it as we were outside in the picnic. He said, if the government gets so large that it needs more than imposts, which are import taxes on goods that are brought in, he said, if it gets larger than what it can, he said, it will be a tyranny. If it has more money to play with, the more money it gets, the more corrupt it will become. So no direct taxation on the people. The 10th Amendment changed Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution. Let me see if I can find this now. I wanted to, here it is. How many people knew that the Bill of Rights had a preamble? Very important. What is a preamble? Preamble is a declaration of intent. The preamble to the U.S. Constitution has no legal standing whatsoever. It's a declaration of intent. So every time the Supreme Court jumps at the General Welfare Clause, all these other clauses, you know, all of the good, happy things that are mentioned in the preamble, they are touching on something they have that does not exist. It has no legal context. I will read you the preamble to the Bill of Rights, just the first paragraph. The conventions of a number of the states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. Article 1, Section 1 states, and people, words mean something. And if we have a president who has a problem with the word is, then he wouldn't understand any of this. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. Granted. What is the definition of granted? To bestow or confer, especially by a formal act. If I grant you something, can I take it back? Not legally. If you're granted something, and Article 1, Section 1 says the legislative powers herein granted, the 10th Amendment says the powers not delegated. There's a difference in words. If I delegate something to you, I can take it back. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Did our founders intend for the Supreme Court to decide whether anything is constitutional or not? Our founders did not intend for the federal government to have anything to do with we the people. They were to deal strictly with the states. They were to have no signatory effect on the individuals of this country under their specifically delegated powers. Have they exceeded them? We've got seven, I call them clowns in black gowns. We've got one lady who sits on there who actually wrote an opinion as an appellate court judge that said that sex between adults and children should not be illegal. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We can go to the other side of the spectrum and we can look at Mr. Roberts that found that Obamacare was a tax when it specifically says that it is not a tax. The Supreme Court once ruled that a window washer who could look through a window and see a telephone was involved in interstate commerce because you could call somebody in another state from that telephone. The Supreme Court once said that a farmer who produced all of his own food for his animals was violating interstate commerce because by not buying from people in other states, he was interfering with the process. And need I tell you that in 1858 they said slavery was legal? Those are the people I want making important decisions for me, right? But yet the majority of the people in this country believe that when the Supreme Court says something, by golly, we got to live with it. We may not like it, but we got to live with it. Which takes me back to we the people. We the people was argued in every ratifying convention. Why? We all like that, don't we? How many times do we hear people in our group say, "We the people of the United States"? We the people signifies a nationalist form of government with a central consolidated head. Patrick Henry said, "Why didn't you say we the states?" But there is a valid reason for that. The initial preamble said, "We the people of," and it named all 13 colonies. Just as the Treaty of France. When King George III signed a peace treaty with the people in this country, he said it must be every state must sign this. You can't sign it as a whole. So they got 5 days before they were ready to turn over the Constitution. They were ready to vote on it. 5 days before they got there, Elbridge Gerry said, "Uh-oh, Article 7 of the Constitution. We only need 9 states to ratify this thing. What happens if everybody doesn't ratify it? We have to go back to the preamble and take their names out." So they fell on we the people of the United States. But all of the people in all of the states were concerned about that because they said, "You take us from a federated government to a national government under one head. And we don't want that. We want the states to remain our governing bodies." So there we have, I had a lot more. I always plan for a lot more. But I don't want to go too far. We're pretty far along anyway. I don't want to keep anybody up too late. I write articles on a fairly regular basis. Thomas, you asked for me to look at one end specifically, if you will remember. You don't. Oh, okay. Now, if any of you would like to subject yourself to the pain and suffering of reading my stuff, if you would like to be on my list, please provide me with an email address. And if you get an email that says Montezuma Constitution, that's me. So, you know, most people might not want to read it, but it's there. But some people, young lady up here to my left, said that she went back and read some of my stuff before. And I'm going to read you this article and finish with this and then accept as many questions as we have time for, Thomas. The title of my article was Be Afraid. Be Very Afraid. And I made some quotes. I got some quotes. The first one is, this whole conspiracy idea is cockeyed. We had orders to obey the head of state. We weren't a band of criminals meeting in the woods in the dead of night to plan mass murders. Anybody got any idea who that came from? A fellow by the name of Hermann Göring. Here's another one for you. I was given this assignment, which I could not refuse. And besides, I did everything possible to treat them well. Fritz Sockel, 23 February 1946, hanged for crimes against humanity. Another Nazi. Another quote, I don't see how they can fail to recognize a soldier's obligation to obey his orders. That's the code I have lived by all my life. Alfred Jodl, 1 December 1945, hanged for crimes committed. Now here's my part. I fully understand why people get very defensive whenever any acts by supposedly good Americans are compared to Hitler and Nazi Germany. But when considering the rapid descent into abject socialism in this country during the past 12 to 14 years, would it be time to take the gloves off and realize we seem to be following in the footprints of history? Oh, we are nothing like the Nazis. I hear the chorus now. But the president can order the death or imprisonment of an American citizen without a trial. National Defense Authorization Act 2012. We have socialized medicine, Obamacare, and W. Bush's Part D Medicare plan. Our Bill of Rights has been eviscerated. Patriot Act, Department of Homeland Security. Please name one of the above that in any way conflicts with the principles of Nazi Germany. Is it just coincidence that Adolf Hitler used the term protect the homeland in the speech when he created the Gestapo, and George W. Bush used the exact same phrase in his news conference after 9/11? Good arguments could be made on both sides, I am sure. The crucial issue here is the failed concept prevailing among many in our country that whatever the government says, whether they say it through enacted legislation or regulation or by some government bureaucracy, it is to be treated as gospel and obeyed without discussion. Whether we are like Nazi Germany or rapidly getting there, the basic premise that government is the almighty is the vehicle which leads to destruction of liberty and individual sovereignty and the advent of heinous crimes by government. We have a local representative here in Colorado who has stated publicly that, and I quote, no law is unconstitutional until the Supreme Court says it is. We also have a candidate for sheriff who says that all laws that emanate from the government will be enforced should he become sheriff. Both happen to be Republicans. But for the sake of brevity, we shall skip over this broad discussion of that point in this offering. To believe that the people who created our government through our states were to become its slaves and subject to its every whim would have been a real surprise to our ancestors who voted in the various state ratification conventions to approve this form of government, for they were told if they voted to ratify our Constitution, the exact opposite would be true. The real question is, do those who advocate the government must be obeyed regardless of the law passed or regulation written do so from a true philosophical belief or from sheer ignorance of the constitutional principles they have sworn to uphold and defend from all enemies, foreign and domestic? How does one in good conscience take a sacred oath to uphold and defend the Constitution and Bill of Rights and then claim they will uphold, defend, and enforce any law passed by a government? Another question is, do they have a working knowledge of the Constitution that would enable them to know the difference? I skip away from this for something that I saw recently where Congressman Lo Bianco in New Jersey was asked by a reporter, could you please explain the meaning of Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution? And he said, freedom of press. I will offer below as a classic example of a person holding a very important position in government publicly claiming they are not qualified for the job they were elected to do. And if you'll listen real carefully, most of the people in government will tell you at some point in time, I don't have a clue what I'm doing. And this one happened to be with a sheriff in Colorado. We had a huge issue when the Democrats took control of the legislature and proposed a lot of absolutely asinine against the Second Amendment. And we had a brilliant member of our legislature state that women on college campuses did not need to be armed because when attacked, they could always pee on their assailant.
Or vomit.
Yes, or vomit. I'm sorry. I kind of like the pee part. And another one. One of the brilliant ones stood up and said, you women don't have to worry out there because if you are being attacked, just hold your hand up to your head like you're on your cell phone. They'll leave you alone. I'm not exaggerating, people. And then we had another lady who was recalled successfully. He said she didn't understand the big deal about magazines holding a lot of rounds because she said once you use them, they're done. You can't use them again. You know what's really amazing is you and I elected these idiots. I agree. But I've tried to point this out to the people, especially in Colorado. The office of sheriff in Colorado is created by the state constitution. Colorado Constitution, Article 14, Section 8. The Constitution does not enumerate particular duties of a sheriff. Did you know that? Colorado statutes do specify various duties for sheriffs, most of which are restatements of the sheriff's traditional common law powers and duties. I love that word, common law. Common law, natural law. My quotes from the beginning. You have certain unalienable rights because you are. As Jefferson said, they were granted by our Creator. Now, folks, you can give them away. Legally, they can't be taken. For example, to keep and preserve the peace in their respective counties and to quiet and suppress all affrays, riots, and unlawful assemblies and insurrections. That's what it says our sheriff's supposed to do. Doesn't say a doggone word about enforcing the law. I'm not familiar with your constitution. You might want to look at that and see. Because every candidate for sheriff I've ever seen tells me they have to enforce the law. It's not in the Constitution. Let me move on here. To appoint some proper person under sheriff. That's in the statutes. Colorado Revised Statutes, Section 3010-501, et sec. Nothing in the list of statutory duties requires sheriffs to enforce every state statute or any federal law, for that matter. In Colorado, the sheriffs take a very simple oath of office. I, blank, do solemnly swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the State of Colorado, the ordinances of our county, and that I will faithfully perform the duties of the office of county sheriff of the county of State of Colorado upon which I enter. The oath is in the form required by the Colorado Constitution, Article 12, Section 8. Which reads as follows, every civil officer except members of the General Assembly and such inferior officers as may be by law exempted shall, before he enters upon the duties of his office, take and subscribe an oath or affirmation to support the Constitution of the United States and the State of Colorado, and to faithfully perform the duties of the office upon which he shall be about to enter. There is absolutely not to be found in the oath of office or the articles of the Colorado Constitution anything that states the sheriff must uphold and defend the laws of the state of Colorado or of the United States. Could it be that since the sheriff swears to uphold and defend the Constitution of Colorado and the U.S., that covers any and all laws that are created in pursuance of the Constitution, and the occupant of the office of sheriff is presumed to have a working knowledge of both in order to determine if those laws are indeed constitutional? If not, each person who takes that solemn oath not equally responsible is not. Each person who takes that solemn oath not equally responsible for assuring to those whom they serve a strict adherence to the principles of those documents and to uphold and defend them against any unconstitutional edicts submitted by either government. Is it possible to be faithful to one's oath while at the same time enforcing unconstitutional laws? When any member of government seeks to enforce an unconstitutional law, they become the domestic enemy to that document. I won't go through the idiot sheriff from Arapahoe County and what he said. Oh, I do? Okay, sorry. He said, although I have great respect and admiration for each of my colleague sheriffs and police chiefs across the country, I take exception with the handful of public servants who have suggested that they would reject enforcement of any unconstitutional mandates specifically related to the Second Amendment. My comment was, how can, and I sent this to him. He didn't respond. How can one have a valid enforceable law that contradicts the Constitution? If an issue were to be arbitrarily deemed unconstitutional, the decision to curtail further enforcement responsibilities would be in direct conflict with the concept of the balance of powers as defined by our founders. And my comment was, ouch. Perhaps the good sheriff has never heard of one Thomas Jefferson who stated, "My construction of the Constitution is that each department is truly independent of the others and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the case submitted to, in any case submitted to its action." Perhaps that is why they all take an oath to uphold and defend. Then he said, "Public safety professionals serving in the executive branch do not have the constitutional authority, responsibility, and in most cases the credentials to determine the constitutionality of any issue." And my response was, "Well, Sheriff, if you do not possess the authority, responsibility, or the credentials to determine the constitutionality of any issue, you should immediately resign, for in your statement you admit to having little to no knowledge of the documents you swore to uphold and defend. Such knowledge would prepare you to possess the authority, responsibility, and certainly the credentials which you wear on your uniform shirt to determine the constitutionality of any act. Your statement is a bold admission. You do not have the knowledge necessary to protect the rights of those who pay your salary." Then he went on to say, "The authority and responsibility to determine the legality and or the constitutionality of a matter is to be accomplished by the judicial branch, as clearly defined in the Constitution." My response, "Gosh, Sheriff, sure do wish you would have cited chapter and verse on this bold but incorrect assertion. It would appear your lack of knowledge is quite extensive." Again, from Mr. Jefferson, "Nothing in the Constitution has given the judges a right to decide for the executive, more than to the executive to decide for them. Both magistrates are equally independent in the sphere of action assigned to them, and to consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions is a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal, knowing that to whoever hands confided with the corruptions of time and party, its members would become despots. it has more wisely made all the departments co-equal and co-sovereign within themselves. And finally, the sheriff's coup de grace. We are a nation of laws. Factually, our founders never intended for this to be a nation, and this is my response, for our decisions are made through representatives and not in the aggregate, which is the very definition of a nation. So, Sheriff, you are wrong on that count, and also we are not an anything of laws. We are a country with a constitution and a Bill of Rights, which defines what is and what is not constitutional. Laws do not decide for themselves if they are valid. I would remind you that Nazi Germany was a nation of laws, and everything Adolf Hitler did was legal. Law, has anyone ever heard of Jeremy Locke? It's on my reading list. The End of Evil. Have you read The End of Evil? I will quote from The End of Evil. Law is a weapon. It is used by evil to attack its prey. Whether in the name of duty to king, loyalty to state, or rule of law, law is the weapon used to extort and control. Culture upholds the nobility of law. Culture teaches that law is proper and good. It never questions who wrote the law. Tyrant and brother are the same. Culture never questions whether or not the law is right. You are to obey no matter what it says. In this fashion, law is a powerful weapon to be used against you. When anyone tells you that law must be obeyed and will be enforced, please remember that there is a choice, liberty or tyranny, and blind obedience. You decide. Should you decide to support the party favorite and the candidate endorsed, of course we have a contentious sheriff race going, which I have had nothing to do with. I lied. I take this opportunity to remind you, let me get the whole thing here. Should you decide to support the party favorite and the candidate endorsed by the local socialist birdcage liner, I take this opportunity to remind you of the words of Samuel Adams. May your chains rest lightly upon you, and may posterity forget ye were our countrymen. So I got about 2 days more left, but people are probably going to need to go somewhere tomorrow. So I would like to open up for questions, if I may. Is that okay, Thomas? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Ma'am, and please pardon me, folks. I got to tell you something that happened, which really, and this was 2008, and I was down in Arizona, Winslow, Arizona, standing on a corner. I was invited down, and I've talked to Constitution down there, and I was invited down by the chairman of the Republican Party of, I think it's Navajo County. I'm not sure. Is that Navajo County? I was invited by the chairman to come down because they were entertaining presidential candidate John McCain. 3 times during that presentation in Winslow, Arizona, that beautiful lady who invited me down there stood up and asked him about Obama's birth. And was he a U.S. citizen? John McCain refused to answer all 3 times. He ignored her. He turned to someone else and took another question. So my grandpa, who lived to be 100, told me many years ago, he said, "Son, the Democrats and Republicans are just two wings of the same buzzard." So, but yes, ma'am, it is possible to commit treason even if you are not a citizen, according to our Constitution. You'll find that in Article 3 of the Constitution. You know, that is much too nice to use on him. I have my own thoughts. I'll probably better keep them to myself, but you know, back in 2000, early part, any of you people ever heard of the SHOT Show? Well, I used to go every time, and I was actually in, and I've got witnesses to this now. We were at the SHOT Show in Orlando, Florida, and we're sitting at a table, quite a few of us people who deal in firearms. We're sitting at a table, and everybody was talking about what a terrible time 2008 was going to bring us because Hillary was going to be running as the Democratic candidate. And I said, no way. And some people said, what do you mean? And I said, my grandpa told me when the river runs backwards, son, somebody's messing with it. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, Illinois senatorial election 2 years ago. We are a few short years removed from 9/11, and a man with an Arab name is elected governor of a state in our country. And not only that, but he ran against another black man who had name recognition. And Alan Keyes only got 11% of the vote. Diebold, it's, you know, when the river runs backwards like that, they had plans for this guy. He got cheated. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. No. I will address my opinion. I do not believe in an Article 5 convention. And for one simple reason is we had a U.S. Constitutional Convention that was hijacked. Who are going to be the delegates to this Constitution? Who's going to pick them? And with our wonderful record of voting constitutional people into office, are we the people capable of electing the right people to go there? You know, during the Constitutional Convention, no one wanted the people of this country, except finally they agreed on it. George Mason, Benjamin Franklin, so many of them said the people shouldn't be allowed to elect the president of the country because they weren't paying enough attention. And this was how many years ago? We hadn't gotten any better. I do not believe it's a good thing, ma'am. I believe if we would go back to the U.S. Constitution as ratified, we got it nailed. Because, and we had this discussion outside, and I've had some constitutional classes where I've had people get up and leave, and that's okay. And then, you know, I'm pretty thick-skinned. I've had people say, well, do you believe the Constitution was inspired by God? And I say, no. But I'm going to tell you this. There were some godly people there in those ratification conventions that made it what it should be. And my other reason is God doesn't make mistakes. So I'm sure I've had people disagree with me, and that's fine. I still love you. Any other questions? You guys keep looking at me back there. You got to ask me something. Excuse me. Article 1 on presidential duties?
No, Article 1, Section 8.
Oh, okay. All right, I got you now. George Mason had a quote for you, and I'll have to paraphrase. I can't remember it exactly. But he said, if we allow the president too much latitude, and in our Constitution, no president was allowed the latitude these people take. Right. And you're exactly right. And George Mason said that if we allow this to happen, we will have the worst type of monarchy, an elected one. Well said, and I totally agree with you, and I've told people I've got about 400 and some people on my email list, and I sent out an email, and I said, if you send me an email that has Obama in the line, I will delete it. I don't have time for that because it is a diversion. The press, and they all keep these diversions going to keep us looking from the real issue. There's one other thing I needed to touch on very quickly. Let me touch on a couple other things. Thank you. Pardon me for cutting you short, but there were three things I needed to get in here. And when I talked about the two constitutions, one as ratified and one as interpreted. People, we have three amendments to the Constitution that we follow religiously that were never properly ratified, 14th, 16th, and 17th. All three of them were never properly ratified. And the 16th one was about the income tax. And the 17th eliminated any possibility of a federal government and turned it into a national government because our founders, if you will read those ratification conventions, the state legislators were to elect the senators, and that provided so many breaks against this all this thing. And on your point, if you happen to read any of my articles, I touch on exactly what you're saying because I teach classes on preparation, survival, and a lot of other things, and I'm not a survival prepper. At least I won't be on TV. Yes, sir. Yep. I can't think of his name either. But I wouldn't trust anybody with a star on his shoulder. You don't get there by being constitutional, let me promise you. Smedley Butler, that was a long time ago, Pard. Smedley Butler, the only two-time recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor in the U.S. Marine Corps. The Marines don't like to talk about him because he wrote a book called War is a Racket. He also, yeah, that's a classic book, and there's another one for you to read by Randolph Bourne called War is the Health of the State. You have another question, sir? There's one thing that worries me terribly, and that was in 2003 and 2004, my United States Army dropped any exclusion for convicted felons because they needed people who could fog a mirror to go to war. They have reinstated it now that you can't get in if you're a convicted felon. But my son, who was a captain, he said, we had every gang known in America represented in uniform. So if you think, when they say if they order the Army to go confiscate guns or something, if you think you're depending on people who's going to care about the Constitution, you're wrong. Randolph Bourne, it's actually, he didn't complete it before he died. It's called War is the Health of the State. Yes, ma'am. It matters locally, ma'am. That's the only place I vote is locally. I don't vote in national elections. I might as well stand out in the yard and throw rocks at them. Well, there is recourse, and the Constitution provides it. But remember what my first question was? Do you like to be comfortable? Exactly, ma'am. The Constitution provides for that. It provides for us, and if I may use the phrase, we the people. It provides for us. We have a lot of rights, but you don't have any rights you're not willing to fight for. And we have rights, and they're constitutional. We do not employ them. We do not stand for those rights that we have. And one of the things, how many of us avoid jury duty? We have the ability to sit on a jury and tell the judge what to do. He doesn't have the right to tell us what to do. We've fallen into that paradigm to where we think that clown with a black gown has some kind of special influence, and he doesn't, or she doesn't. Have you ever heard of a common law grand jury? It's provided for in the Constitution. A common law grand jury is made up. A common law grand jury is the fourth article. It's not owing any allegiance to either one of the three branches of government. A common law grand jury can be drawn up, and they can indict anybody in their county. If you have a judge who says, no, I'm not going to do that, and it's unconstitutional, a common law grand jury indicts him. We have the power, we just won't use it. Because we're comfortable. Oh, lawyers don't know the Constitution, ma'am.
Lawyers work for the crown.
They're As a matter of fact, there was an amendment. Actually, lawyers aren't citizens. According to the Constitution, because you can't have a title of nobility, read it. I got some issues with him. I got some issues with him in Nevada saying he was going to put the men and women in front to be shot. I got some issues with that. Sir, if you would, there's some people who probably want to leave. Let's have the closing prayer, and then we can all stay. Anybody who wants to stay, we'll take care of that.
Could we give a round of applause to Michael Gaddy, please?